Thank you very much. Hello, my name is Navi Kikabine. I want to talk to you about inclusion and equal opportunities and how these need to be at the heart of the education provision at every level. And I'll be referring to some notes, and I said earlier that to Melian that these notes that I'm referring to will be made available. And I've also put some slides together, if that's helpful for people. And I believe that they will be made available through a website. Also, talking to understand that ALFE, also the Alliance for Inclusive Education, would also make available the notes that I'm using today. So, in this talk to you today, I want to draw upon some of the work by American philosopher Stanley Cavell, particularly his work on speech acts, but who heavily leant upon G.L. Austin, a British philosopher. And then I want to draw upon the issue of special educational needs, in particular how I'm going to argue that the way in which special education has been understood is intentionally segregated disabled young people. And that it's problematic, and I'm going to share some preliminary concerns about the new education, health and care plan. I want to also share with you in this short talk to you about my own personal experiences of having supported young people and families over a period of up to 30 years now, and a pattern emerging about those concerns. And then part of this, I want to share with you a letter that I received from a young person who's age 6, and I'd like to read that to you. Finally, in this talk to you, I'd like to share with you concerns within the not just secondary school sector, but also the further education and higher education too. And then finally, I want to return to the letter that I received from this young person. So, beginning this then, thinking about the work of Stanley Cavell, he basically argued that one of the key points for him in terms of speech acts was that talking together is acting together. And primarily, his point was that both things that intricately connected, and we mustn't forget that talking together is acting together. And I want to return to those five terms at the end of this talk. I want to read to you a letter from this young person, and she's 6 years old, and it's a letter regarding a friend she refers to as a best friend, and it's a letter addressed to the governor, head teacher, staff and parents of the school, and it reads this: Dear governors, head teacher, staff and parents, my friend is called David. He is 6 years old. David uses a wheelchair, and he has been told he has learning difficulties. David goes to a special school and says he does not like it. He wants to come to my school. David has been told he can't come to my school, and he is my best friend. I don't understand why he can't come to my school. I've told David that the teachers are nice, and he would enjoy it, and because he is my best friend. Please can David come to my school, as I'm sure the teachers will like him too. And it ends. And just for a moment, I want us to imagine we are the school governor, the head teacher, a parent, or a staff member. And some reflective questions: how should we respond? Should we write back and explain that their friend will be better served in a segregated special school? Should we explain that David will affect the learning of others and he would be better suited in a special school? Should we write back giving due consideration and make reasonable adjustments to support David in his local mainstream school? What issues are involved as to whether this young person attends the mainstream school or not? Should we ignore the letter and hope that the letter writer drops the issue? Well, what is for sure, after heated debate, is that the identification of special educational needs has its foundations firmly rooted in pathologising individuals and, in turn, the families. As is being argued, the language of special educational needs is a language of sentimentality and prejudice. It has become bastardised. It is a misnomer for failure. From such debate, I've heard responses about the difficulties of working in such schools, about the lack of resources, about the difficulties of recruiting long-term staff, lack of qualified staff, lack of training, staff rivalries, cultures of silences, narrow curriculum opportunities, and limited choices, etc., etc. I've also heard responses about mainstream schools too, but primarily about the lack of support and about young people being expected to go into discrete provision with prettily named classes such as Rainbow Class or Safe Rooms. Such considerations and reasoning forget, I argue, about the voice of the individual. My argument is that it involves problem-infused ideas about what it means to be a disabled person. Warnock argued that in her work, and I'm sure you're familiar with this, that 20% of the school population at some point would be described as having special educational needs. And I say that Warnock has been a myth-maker. Misleadingly worked with the figure of 20%, and the idea that between of that 20%, 2 and 3% of those young people would be expected to go to segregated provision, i.e. a special school. These figures she openly remarked upon as being a kind of guess, and extremely misleading. She also said, evaded the issue about full integration, which she referred to as an ideological hot potato. It wasn't that it was not possible, she says, but it was not desirable. And there's a big difference. It's not that it's not possible, but that it's not desirable. Warnock's initial reasoning was related to young people who were deaf children, and those other children who were ineloquently labelled with pseudo-medical terms such as emotional behavioural difficulties. She also linked, and I think this is key, she linked cost of an individual's education and their apparent, and I quote, little or no value to the national economy. Interestingly, and apparently taking a new look in 2005, Warnock suggested now that her gaze has turned to people who've been labelled as having autism. Warnock made no serious contribution or connection with disabled people, and certainly not with disabled people's contribution to work. And it's interesting, and relatedly, Anne Borthe, who argues about, writes about disabled people's contribution during the war effort, and it's interesting that we've just passed Armistice Day, and that many disabled men and women contributed significantly to the war effort, and yet this continues to be a hidden subject even in our curriculum areas. And it's interesting how this year's Disability History Month has picked up the issue of disability and war and the effects of disablement. But going back to the debate, discussion around SEN versus mainstream education, I would argue, invites prejudice, discrimination and hostility towards disabled people. It's a misleading debate. It's one in which we are invited to make discriminatory comments. It invites us to make decisions about people's lives. Would we tolerate such debate if we began to invite views about educational segregation determined by race, determined by gender, determined by sexuality, for example? And I'm arguing that no, we would not. Well, why? Because we would have come to accept that separating individuals is not equal. The bureaucratic statementing process, and I think too, the incoming education health care plan, process not only elevates what is written about, but pitches family members against each other, and in turn, local authorities. Given Warnock's lack of engagement with disabled people, it's not surprising to me and many other disabled people and allies that it took nearly two decades for her to finally conclude that the real evil, she says, is the system of statementing itself. Apart from the rare exception of the push for parents to secure mainstream schooling for their son or daughter has invariably been a battle. There has never been a bias towards inclusion. From my experience of nearly 30 years, it has come at a significant personal and emotional cost. And for the record, I don't hold out much optimism for the new Education, Health and Care Plan. When did health intervene in educational matters? Like the struggles of women and how medicine has invited itself to control women's lives, so has medicine in a large part controlled the lives of disabled people. There are many disabled people who are not ill. What is the new approach with the Education, Health and Care Plan? What significant changes will the new plan coordinator role entail? Shall we role play another debate, discuss the multiple roles of this new coordinator, and forget about the roots of such debate? Over two decades, I have been working with parents and young people attempting to gain access to mainstream schools, and less so, but increasingly, and this is important, colleges and universities. To share some examples, I recently have been working with a parent who have a son who is seeking to attend a local mainstream school in the Borough of London. The young person has been labelled as having severe learning difficulties. The Borough forwarded previous statements to four potential local schools, and in response, none of those schools wrote anything positive about this young person. They were entirely negative, framed around what he could not do. There was no mention in the school's responses of any reasonable adjustments. In part, these letters were prejudicial and arguably amounted to direct discrimination and hostility. The family were distraught, given their son was having such a positive experience in his local primary school. Staff at the primary school are willing to work with the local mainstream school. Each of the letters suggested a special school, which at first the family had not ruled out, but on asking questions about this provision, meeting and listening to disabled people, the parents became aware of segregated practices. Small group teaching meant one-to-one, and sometimes for full days. Endless repetitive tasks, independent life skills, cooking, learning to eat, were all typical curricular activities. The mother told me that her daughter, being upset, finding her at times in tears, that it seemed to her daughter that, and the daughter said, nobody wanted her brother. Another family I'm currently working with involves a young disabled person whose parents moved to England from Ghana, Africa, some 10 years ago. Their son, being born in England, is currently finding the transition from primary to secondary school difficult. He reports that some of the other children have been teasing and bullying him. During the first week in the secondary school, he was chewing gum and was told to remove this from his mouth, which he did. He was then told to attend an isolation room, where he claimed that he needed the toilet. In his words, he was bursting. A teacher refused this young disabled person to go to the toilet, and he pushed the teacher aside to make it to the toilet. This disabled young person has since been excluded from that school for 4 days. Unsurprisingly, the parents are distraught. It has been some time, but I've worked in the adult education sector too. I recall meeting an individual who would have been labelled as having learning difficulties and was attending, as the language of that time, a basic skills course. Familiarly transformed to, ironically, Skills for Life, which specifically focused on numeracy. And at the time, I was teaching mathematics at that time, and this particular individual approached me, intrigued about the course. We had a conversation, and he expressed a desire to attend the GCSE A level mathematics course I was teaching, and he showed me his files, and they were meticulously ordered, and I said, come along, come to the course. Anyway, he shared this desire with the basic skills numeracy teacher, and he was told to stay on the numeracy course. And for many of us who've worked in the Adult Education Centre, you'll be aware of the phenomena referred to as the revolving door syndrome. And this particular young man, he would have been in his late 20s, he had been on this basic skills course for 8 years. For many people in the adult education sector, that is not uncommon. And interestingly, I was affronted by this tutor too, with the comment, I'm getting fed up of hearing your name. With regards to my experience of working in the higher education sector, I've gained a number of insights into experiences of exclusion. For example, on one occasion, a British white mature student who was in the process of completing a primary teacher education programme at another university contacted me with regard to an instance whilst on placement where a young Pakistani child was being unfairly treated by a tutor. Just to go into detail, this particular student was on placement, and she told me that her mentor at the school began to confide in her about this particular child. And typical things went on in the classroom, and the example she gave, when the mentor was confiding in this student, the student shared with me an incident when children had a birthday, for example, it was common practice that the teacher and the other children sang happy birthday to the children. But when it was this young Pakistani child's birthday, no birthday song was sung. After that time, the mentor confided in this student on placement that the children were asked to do an activity, and it was something to do with the seasons of the year, and children were expected to dress up to reflect the various seasons. And this particular Asian boy was told to represent summer. And so the very next day, before assembly, he, underneath his garments, he put on his swimming trunks. And the student who was the mentor observed this young boy shivering and feeling awkward. And this student had not observed this, but the mentor was confiding in the student. Then what happened was that the student told me she didn't really want to know it, but it was forthcoming. And the tutor was asked to have a meeting with the parents. So when the child had gone home, had explained what happened, the parent came in the next day to have a chat with the teacher and said kindly, if you're doing work like that, my son really finds it embarrassing to wear just trunks in front of everybody else, and I would very much appreciate it if next time you do an activity like that, maybe you could represent winter. Anyhow, the mentor confided in the student on placement and dramatised almost the reenactment of what happened. And what happened, the student told me, was the tutor took the child out of the class and said to this young pupil, "You fucking tell your parents ever again," pointing a finger, "you're in for it." Now, this is what the student confided in to me. In supporting this individual through the complaints procedure, I observed, so to speak, the walls of the institution closing in. Meetings were held without the student's presence. It was the student who was euphemistically shown the door. And it's those kinds of incidences that I've raised concerns about. I've witnessed in higher education institutions conceptually challenged, if you allow me to say so, heads of departments, directly disadvantage and discriminate against disabled students. Modern higher education, I argue, is intentionally exclusionary. They are inherently riddled with inequalities. In part, they are frequented by individuals with doctoral caps with bells on, as Foucault suggests, with an excessive desire for individualism, self-gratification, and are discriminatory towards disabled people. And we've heard recently about the reshaping of disabled students' allowance and the concerns for many disabled people and groups who are campaigning about the rightful place of disabled students within higher education. Interestingly, Henry Giroux has inferred in a chapter entitled Beyond the Swindle of Corporate Universities, universities have become, quote, theatres of cruelty. They have lost their way, they ignore their civic responsibility, I argue, for social and cultural good. We need to reclaim education in totality. My personal experiences and perspectives have been informed from various disabled people, from being a son to parents. My father arrived in England in 1956, and my mother later followed in 1961. They both acquired impairments, and from being a brother to siblings who lived the experience of discrimination termed disability. I've made representations at tribunals and on issues both of racial discrimination and disability discrimination. Have observed with and through my father's experience issues related to services for disabled older people. I've listened to numerous individuals in schools, colleges and educational centres and universities telling me about the encounters of unfair, unjust and discriminatory practices and attitudes. What I have observed is the way services such as hospitals, charities, day centres, segregated special schools, social services are special services. They are for surveillance and institutionalisation. They are part of what has come to be known as the disability industry. And of course, there are abundant profits to be made in this work. Outside of family life, I've met numerous disabled people who I've had the privilege to know and be mutually part of each other's lives. Understanding disability, I argue, is extremely complex. There are concerns with the tradition of enlightenment, notions of truth, rationalism, the arguments of existence. Bodies with impairments are routinely described in terms of what they cannot do. The leper house, the asylum, the workhouse, the institution, the segregated special school are an important reminder of the way vulnerable people, people made vulnerable, the poor, people made poor, disabled people, people made disabled, are under intense scrutiny. Arguably, this is a complex society, and the model that we have had of segregation was a pattern that we've repeated even to this day. As educational institutions take shape, policy and legislative rhetoric take hold, questions emerge as to the exclusion of disabled people. Particular individuals labelled have learning difficulties. Namely, I argue, questions of discrimination continue. Alongside the political activism of disabled people, legislative irregularities are being increasingly challenged. Decades of disabled policy, including educational policy, often overlapping and interconnecting, form a complex web of relationships, and they have contradictory aims and values. Demands for an alternative model of education informed by the social model of disability have been raised, suggesting that the educational environment, teaching, learning and assessment should change in order for barriers to be removed. Well, guess what? Disabled and non-disabled first and second generation, alongside disabled people more generally, have grown up together. We have developed friendships. We have been talking and acting together, making alliances based on shared values. These are universal values around justice, equality and empowerment. We have protested together about the segregation of disabled people, educational cuts and the increasing marketisation and privatisation of education. The time is here and the time is now. We demand better of our education and that discrimination and segregation be tackled in all their forms. Fully resourced mainstream schools, learning, teaching, support staff, who are trained to identify barriers, learning, teaching and schools which value and celebrate difference will meet this demand, I would argue. It will require wholesale restructure of education in totality and ultimately the dismantling of segregated special schooling provision. It is schools that have learning difficulties, colleges have severe learning difficulties and universities have profound and multiple learning difficulties. Why? Because they refuse to learn from those it intentionally excludes. It is time to stop this educational tinkering, I argue, as has others, and build a fully inclusive education system befitting for all, if it is to be equal for all. It is apt for me to conclude then on my earlier experience of receiving a letter from a young person aged 6, acting on their best friend's wish to be included in a local mainstream school, and the reminder of those first 5 words, namely, that talking together is acting together. Thank you.